Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 347 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Lydia Sisson reflects on the particular kinds of truth that fiction can reveal, considers the radical history of her maternal forebears, and puts the case for novel reading as an essential element of historical research.
It's not that I leave nothing to chance when I go on holiday. I simply like to be prepared. Most importantly, I like to be imaginatively primed for whatever I might encounter. So, long before I've checked ferry times, restaurants, or walking maps, I'm plotting my reading. And that usually means tracking down the novels I want to absorb before I arrive in a new place. A few years ago, heading for the Accursed Mountains in Albania, I left with my mental rucksack packed with the characters, landscapes and moods of novels by Ismail Kadare, Pashtim Statovski, a Finnish Albanian Kosovan writer, and Lloyd Jones, a New Zealander. Biography: Jones's story of Albania after the death of Enver Hoxha, a quest for a disappearing dentist who had supposedly been the dictator's body double, bears the subtitle A Traveller's Tale. Surely an obvious wink. These days, it might be shelved as autofiction. Yet in the early 1990s, bizarre and naive as this now seems, the book's US publisher was outraged and some critics exasperated to discover that the book was no travelogue, but an untrustworthy tapestry of fact and fiction. Of course, the constant threat that the text's indistinguishable warp and weft may suddenly unravel is largely the point of this book. How does a once-closed country kept for decades in secrecy and lies know whom or what to trust? The book's main title, Biography, refers to the state-maintained dossiers that determined every Albanian citizen's life chances under communism. But it also helps signal the writer's interest in how identity is constructed, bloodlines and paper trails. The importance of blood in Albania's earlier history is explored in Kadare's Broken April, a novel set in the 1930s about an anthropologist's working honeymoon collecting evidence of blood feuds. When I finally get to Albania, I greet mushroom pillboxes and windowless towers and terrifying mountain passes with a sense of recognition. All those stories already in my head now have visible locations right in front of me. I know exactly what I'm seeing, and my understanding, though incomplete, is of a texture and complexity more satisfying and pleasurable than anything extractable from a small boxed explanation in a guidebook. For writers, as for travellers, fiction offers a form of understanding and experience not easily defined. It feels intangible. Its value is often overlooked or underestimated, relegated to a second-order kind of knowledge without the heft or solid status of facts like death certificates and census rolls. Right now, switching genres, turning from writing novels to writing biography again, and reading both, I find myself thinking hard about how best to use every form of evidence I meet. There's always a question of how far to trust diaries and letters and autobiographies, but what weight can I reasonably give to novels? How do different kinds of fiction offer a biographer different forms of evidence? And what can you do with the kind of knowledge that can neither be measured nor tested? Underpinning the writing of historical fiction is a subtle process of absorbing research in a way that makes it almost indistinguishable from memory or your own dreams. It's the very opposite of researching non-fiction. Instead of keeping careful track of sources, instead of leaving a succession of signposts pointing in a clear direction, a neat and orderly series of footnotes, you want your reader to forget there's even such a thing as a source. To reach this point, I tend to steer clear of other people's novels, or at least of modern ones set in a similar period or location. I don't want another writer's images to occlude my own. Fiction, poetry, or plays written at the time my own novel's set are another matter. As well as giving you an ear for particular speech patterns and vocabulary, that kind of material can usefully send you towards the contemporary sources it's cannibalised itself. In the case of my last novel, The Missionary Records of the South Pacific, or simply help you understand a mindset. Without reading Zola's The Belly of Paris, I might have struggled with the idea and ubiquity of delation in 19th century France, the denunciation of your friends and neighbours to the authorities, and no spoilers, delation turned out to be fundamental to a novel I wrote about the 1871 Paris Commune. So where does that leave me now, as after four intensely researched novels I re-enter the non-fiction game, spending most of my days sifting factual evidence of all kinds, chasing lost letters, filling in blanks left in diaries, putting two and two together, reinterpreting real lives. At night, I read novels, not for the usual narrative pleasures, though these are naturally there too, not least since I'm often reading about spies, bomb makers and anarchists, secret police and emigre revolutionaries, but as another kind of source. I don't know yet whether these will prove the footnotable variety. Most will probably end up as invisible in my final manuscript as Zola was in Liberty's Fire. If I want to understand my biographical subjects and all their complexity, I'm convinced that novels are going to be as important as any political pamphlet or archived correspondence. I've long been a little obsessed by the relationship between reading and action. Could reading Robinson Crusoe really have been the spur for a young Frenchman to set out in disguise for Timbuktu in 1827, as I discovered while writing my PhD? How could some awareness of Defoe's novel not have been at the back of the mind of the Victorian patriarch who settled a remote, uninhabited Pacific island in the Kermadec about half a century later? This was the inspiration for my most recent novel. I should probably start constructing a complicated circular diagram with arrows in all directions, or maybe a 3D model. It might also help me sort out in my own mind the delicate, fluctuating relationship in fiction between observation, representation, speculation, and invention. But first, I'll set the scene. When I discovered my Irish great-great-grandmother had been a lifelong friend and comrade of the anarchist Peter Kropotkin after he settled in London in the mid-1880s, I slowly tiptoed with that Paris Commune detour and finally rushed headlong into a world I'd previously encountered before only in fiction. Joseph Conrad's 1907 novel, The Secret Agent, whose plot, Hitchcock borrowed for Sabotage, was written much later than the events which inspired it. In 1894, a mysterious French anarchist accidentally blew himself up outside the Greenwich Observatory, scattering his own body parts across the Royal Park. It's often described as Britain's first international terrorist incident. Obviously, Irish nationalists would take issue with this. In late 19th century Britain, when socialism and anarchism were beginning to define themselves, London balanced two conflicting identities. It was the heart of a benign liberal democracy, which allowed free speech and anarchist printing presses, where international radicals in exile appeared able to associate freely in political clubs and at public meetings and rallies and debate revolutionary ideas. But it was also the centre of a colonial power which oppressed, exploited and policed its subject peoples. Political policing was probably more widespread than we yet know, to judge from the fact that the special branch founded to combat the terrorist menace continues to protect its archive from academic infiltrators with extraordinary vigour. Nobel's invention of dynamite in 1866 had inaugurated a new era of unprecedented violence and threat. Its impact was shattering, psychologically as much as physically, but it was also exciting and hugely appealing to a Victorian readership in love with sensation and melodrama. The anarchist ideal of destruction of the state, allied to a new tactic known as propaganda by the deed, combined to convince the general public that anarchism literally meant anarchy, and that revolution was synonymous with uncontrollable violence. From the early 1880s, over several decades, a frenzied press reported in gruesome detail successive acts of terror in Russia, Germany, America, England, France, Spain, and Austria. Some were successful, such as the 1881 assassination of Tsar Nicholas, others less so. An anarchist attack on the first German Kaiser's carriage miscarried due to damp dynamite. Irish nationalist efforts to blow up London Bridge, Westminster Abbey, the Houses of Parliament and the British Museum all failed too. But outrages in Paris were truly shocking. 20 wounded and one killed at the Café Terminus in 1894. The figure of the bomb maker simultaneously stalked the cultural imagination. Russian nihilists, disguised anarchists, Irish Fenians, secret policemen and new women quickly emerged as stock characters in fiction and on stage. Despite this, my great-great-grandmother, N.F. Dryhurst, made no bones about identifying as an anarchist. She didn't fit the anti-feminist popular newspaper stereotype of the new woman. She didn't go to Cambridge or any other university, nor the female revolutionary, such as Vera, the Russian insurrectionist heroine of Oscar Wilde's first play, a sympathetic character who seems to have been inspired by Vera Zasulich, the would-be assassin of the governor of St. Petersburg. Nanny Dryhurst was an artistic, intellectually curious, but penniless middle-class Dubliner who spent her early 20s as a governess, educating herself as well as her charges, before marrying, moving to Hampstead and becoming a mother. In London, she quickly threw herself into radical politics. The Fabian Society had just been founded. The Socialist League quickly followed. William Morris first published his utopian novels in serial form in its newspaper, The Commonweal. And it was at a party Morris held in the Commonweal office in 1886 that Nanny Dryhurst first met Peter Kropotkin, the celebrated anarchist prince and theoriser of mutual aid. Usually caricatured as an angelic anarchist rather than a bomb maker, Kropotkin, who was well known in Britain for his writing on science and geography in Britain's mainstream periodical press, had little in common with the anarchist plotters of 1880s popular fiction, men such as Zero, the chemist and conspiracist of The Dynamiter, a strangely slippery confection co-written by Robert Louis Stevenson and his wife Fanny, who were well attuned to the surging contemporary market for dynamite novels. In fact, an adventurous, shape-shifting female dynamiter eventually emerges as the Stevenson's titular character. Popular fiction's foreign revolutionists tend to be marked by thick, incomprehensible accents, incompetence or regret. In the Stevenson's novel, the English onlookers they suck in are like innocents abroad, discovering a shadowy, secretive London operating behind closed doors. The novel contains the threat of anarchist terror with surprising narrative twists, sudden unmaskings, considerable humour, and ultimately a marriage plot. So what novels had Dryhurst been reading when she encountered Kropotkin? And what novels had others been writing on the subject of anarchism? A year before she moved to London, Nanny was absorbed by Turgenev, in French, in Dublin. Virgin Soil, the story of a group of middle-class revolutionaries in Tsarist Russia who go to the people to sow democratic ideas and resistance to autocracy. Nanny was very taken with Mariana, a femme du peuple, or woman of the people. Turgenev's early fiction had already been credited with encouraging the Russian aristocracy to realise that serfs were not animals, but human beings with feelings. Memoirs of a Hunter was probably a good nudge towards the Edict of Emancipation of 1861. Kropotkin read Turgenev too. His admiration is clear in his own memoirs of a revolutionist. Kropotkin finally met Turgenev in Paris towards the end of the novelist's life. He was awed by the man and also the size of his brain, which friends had weighed after Turgenev's death. Grant Allen's light novel of 1886, For Mamie's Sake, A Tale of Love and Dynamite, has a good joke about literary realism and also the extent to which Turgenev was required reading for revolutionaries in the making. Mademoiselle Vera Trotsky, the indefatigable secretary of a London-based nihilist group, declares at the end of a meeting that she reads them all as they come out. But she adds, I don't care much for Turgenev now. I've got beyond him. I swear by Zola and the new naturalism. Not long before Nanny Dryhurst launched into her new life as an anarchist and co-founded the long-running newspaper Freedom, she'd been reading Underground Russia, the memoirs of another exiled revolutionary and friend of William Morris, known as Stepniak. As Sergei Kravchinsky, Stepniak had assassinated the head of Russia's secret police, stabbing him on a St. Petersburg street in 1878. A fact few of his English friends knew until shortly before he was killed by a train in West London in 1895. He partly inspired E. Nesbitt's Russian dissident refugee in The Railway Children, a man sentenced to hard labour in Siberia for writing a beautiful book about poor people and how to help them, according to Mother. I'll come back to Nesbitt and her secular saints. In Underground Russia, a source for so many novelists, Stepniak has his own joke. At least I think it is a joke. Describing a secret meeting of terrorists planning the most terrible schemes, he remarks that anyone present who didn't understand Russian would have taken it for a gathering of peaceful folk calmly discussing some harmless matter. He adds, I say this for the guidance of the worthy novelists who have the goodness to represent types of nihilist life. all make them melodramatic heroes, who among us, instead of exciting the enthusiasm attributed to them, would have produced precisely the opposite effect, for they would undoubtedly have aroused suspicions of their firmness by too much eloquence. Both Henry James in the oh-so-fashionable The Princess Casamassima of 1885 and E. Nesbitt seem to have taken note of Stepniak's literary advice. That same year, Edith Nesbitt and her fellow Fabian founder and husband, Hubert Bland, co-produced both a son they named Fabian and a novel whose pseudonymous author was also called Fabian Bland. With its atmosphere of romance and the spice of danger, The Prophet's Mantle is wonderfully melodramatic and passionate about the noble path of utter self-renunciation. The novel swerves disconcertingly from the earnest to the satirical and back again. Full of doubled characters, it features an eloquent fraud, Percival, who impersonates a real Russian revolutionary he believes to be dead, and spends the noble's inheritance on cigars and theatre tickets in the pursuit of women. Curiously, cigars seem to feature a great deal in terrorist novels. The real Count Livitnov is angelic to a Kropotkin-esque degree, a saint of the new religion, and he forgives his former friend. One of Nesbitt and Bland's crueler cameos is a middle-class radical activist surely inspired by Mrs. Charlotte Wilson. As well as being another early Fabian, like my great-great-grandmother, Charlotte Wilson founded an informal political study group to read and discuss first Marx, then Proudhon. Proudhon, as in property is theft. Its secretary was her Cambridge friend Emma Brooke, who earned her living as a writer, pseudonymously exploring socialism in several novels of the mid-1880s. 10 years later, she entered the New Woman fray, carried out largely in the pages of pro-feminist fiction and the anti-feminist popular press. Brooke's first novel under her own name was called A Superfluous Woman, a title that clearly nods to Turgenev's A Superfluous Man. A year later, the year after Bourdin blew himself up in Greenwich Park and inspired Conrad, she published Transition, about a young female Cambridge graduate forced into early financial independence, whose attitudes are transformed by a fellow teacher who turns out to be a fervent socialist. Her friend is then tempted away from socialism into the anarchist movement by a duplicitous and exploitative political exile. The young teacher only steps back from the brink when she realizes this charismatic man wants her to sacrifice herself not as a political martyr, but for his sexual satisfaction. The horror of this is overwhelming. Pneumonia and disillusionment together finish off the young idealist. I would give anything to know Charlotte Wilson's response to her friend's novel. But like so much about the lives of so many of the female foot soldiers of radical political movements, my great-great-grandmother included, such records have not been preserved. And so I am left with novels to help me intuit the conversations they may have had. Crashing into the biographical fallacy, of course I wouldn't dream of reducing any work of art to the experience of its creator. How naive! I swerve back into the path of autofiction. Is it more or less sincerely arch, or indeed archly sincere, these days than in those? Sincerity, or too simplistic an understanding of fictional representation, is a rock on which many critics founder. I was baffled by a recent essay on new translations of Natalie Leger's trilogy of novels, which reads all three uncomplicatedly, admiringly, as narrative essays. How will biographers a century hence read that rash of global anxiety novels? There are probably more to come, responding to the Brexit vote and Trump's election and the climate emergency and the global pandemic. Reading Olivia Lang's crazed Crudo a few years late, the devilish persona-emerging construct of this true news real-time novel turns every reader into a literary voyeur. I found myself laughing, where 2 years earlier I might have wept. You thought it was bad in 2017. You knew nothing. Jenny Offal's Weather had a similar effect. I reckon I'll go back to Ali Smith's latest quartet in about 10 years' time. Unable to bear very much reality, I could only stomach reading the first two as they came out. The experience of reading Crudo late, you take what you find, it's all material, one of its character remarks, reassured me about reading around my ancestors. Factual or otherwise, then and now, fiction feels the perfect way to measure the pulse of a moment. A political movement's propaganda and journalism may tell me what its activists wanted other people to think. Fiction is more fluid, more subtle, Whether written by insiders or outsiders, novels bring you face to face with the hauntings of other people's imaginations, alerting you to what they wondered about, what they thought other people thought, what contradictions they were weighing up. All of which is surely just as valuable as what they actually did.
That was Lydia Sisson. You can find out more about Lydia on her website at www.lydiasisson.com. And that concludes episode 347, which was recorded by Lydia Sisson and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 348, Maggie Butt speaks with Anne Morgan about the transition from poetry to fiction and the resilience needed to write. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.